Welcome to the August 2014 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. This activity is recognized by the American Academy of Dermatology for 2 AAD recognized credits and may be used toward the AAD CME award. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is August 2014. The expiration date is July 2017. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify triggers that contribute to cutaneous aspects of lupus and dermatomyositis, educate patients about triggers that contribute to cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis and preventative strategies, educate patients about triggers that contribute to cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis and preventative strategies, list the recommended tests needed to identify which organ systems are involved in patients with sarcoidosis, and describe the clinical, histological, and laboratory characteristics of sclerosing skin conditions. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Todd Schlesinger has been a principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Abbott Laboratories, Allergan, Inc., Amgen, Astellas Pharma U.S., Inc., Centocor Ortho Biotech, Inc., Genentech, Inc., and Janssen Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and he has been a consultant for and received a salary from Innocutus. Dr. Michael Heffernan has been a principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Abbott Laboratories, Altana, Amgen, Astellas Pharma U.S. Inc., Centocor Ortho Biotech Inc., Galderma Laboratories LP, Genentech Inc., Graceway Pharmaceuticals LLC, and Onset Therapeutics. He has been a principal investigator for and received honoraria from Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Novo Nordisk AS, and Vascular Biogenics. He has been a speaker for and received honoraria from Abbott Laboratories, Amgen, and Janssen Ortho Inc. He has been a consultant for and received honoraria from Janssen Ortho Inc., and he is an employee and receives salary and stock from Eli Lilly and Company. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for August 2014, Volume 70, Issue 8. I hope you're enjoying your summer. In this edition, we have three exciting and timely new dialogues for you, highlighting connective tissue diseases, including cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis, sarcoidosis, and sclerosing skin conditions. Autoimmune connective tissue diseases such as lupus and dermatomyositis often present with cutaneous manifestations. Dermatologists play an important role in the diagnosis and management of these patients. In fact, patient quality of life has been shown to improve as cutaneous disease activity decreases. Often, dermatologists and rheumatologists work together to ensure patients obtain optimal screening and treatment. In our first dialogue, we join Dr. Jenny Clark and Dr. Warren Heyman, who discuss the unique considerations for dermatologists caring for patients with cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis.
Hello, this is Dr. Warren Heyman, and today I have the delightful pleasure of introducing Dr. Jenny Clark. She's an associate professor of dermatology at Penn State University Hershey Medical Center. We're going to be discussing cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis, looking at the management pearls and pitfalls. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you very much.
Today we're going to be discussing the very difficult management problems in both lupus and dermatomyositis. Obviously, there are going to be similarities and differences, but let's just talk about general measures for a moment. How do you advise the use of sunscreen in these patients?
So photosensitivity is actually common in both disorders. At least half of patients with dermatomyositis are photosensitive, and the vast majority of patients with cutaneous lupus are photosensitive. So photoprotection, I think, is really important in both groups of patients. It's something patients sometimes actually underestimate and something all dermatologists have a role in helping them with, because we are the experts at photoprotection and educating patients about photoprotection. And it's something that, as we've learned in our skin cancer patients, needs to be reemphasized at every single visit. And this is true of our patients with lupus and dermatomyositis, whether we're the ones as subspecialists managing their skin disease or whether we're managing them in conjunction with another subspecialist dermatologist or rheumatologist. So we really all have a role to play in talking about photoprotection for both groups of patients.
Now, photoprotection is a broad issue, of course. It's not just sunscreen, it's wearing hat and appropriate clothing. But specifically with sunscreens, are there any you would recommend over others?
So there have been some studies, very small number of studies looking at small numbers of patients, trying to get at that question, is there a specific sunscreen or sunscreen ingredient that is more beneficial in patients with photosensitivity and dermatomyositis and lupus? One study indicated that the sunscreen ingredient Mexoryl might have a beneficial effect in these patients greater than that of other sunscreen ingredients. So if patients are able to utilize products with Mexoryl, this is great. However, there have been a number of other studies which have evaluated non-Mexoryl containing sunscreens and have demonstrated that routine sunscreens that most of us can pick up at any pharmacy or department store can be very helpful in preventing the induction of or worsening of skin disease in both dermatomyositis and lupus. So my personal preference is the sunscreen the patient will use. It should be high SPF, as long as SPFs remain listed on bottles. It should be broad spectrum, and it should be waterproof whether the patients are swimming or not. So those are my main recommendations, and finding one they find cosmetically acceptable and one that they'll use.
And with the new rule, instead of waterproof, we'll have to say water resistant to 80 minutes.
Exactly, yes.
What do you tell patients who spend most of their time indoors and are exposed to fluorescent light?
Fluorescent light does contribute small amounts of UV exposure for our patients. And so there have been studies demonstrating that patients can have some induction of skin lesions from fluorescent lights in general. However, this is probably not a huge factor for most patients. If they sit within very close proximity of a non-shielded fluorescent light, they may have a slightly increased risk of photoinduction or exacerbation of their disease. Acrylic shields can be purchased to shield fluorescent bulbs very inexpensively, about $4 to $5 for a standard acrylic shield, and these completely block UV exposure for these patients. So it's something that can be overcome, probably overall a more theoretical than practical risk, but for patients where this is a real concern, then those shields can be purchased and utilized.
Every so often, I have a patient ask me to write a letter that they get UV filters for their car. Are these actually covered by insurance?
I've written a few of those letters myself, and I have had some patients who have been able to get coverage. I've had others who have not. So I don't think there's a universal correct answer here. I'm happy to write them if a patient spends a great deal of time driving or for any patient who's photosensitive and asks. I have no problem writing such a letter, but I can't make any guarantees for them about whether it'll help them that much in terms of insurance coverage.
Let's talk about the use of topical steroids in these patients. Do you use ultrapotent steroids on facial lesions?
Yes, I definitely do. I use clobetasol or halobetasol, so ultrapotent topical steroids on the face, particularly in patients with discoid lupus erythematosus. In these patients, the lesions are going to result in atrophy and scarring that is far more significant than any atrophy that I'm going to see from topical ultrapotent steroids over the course of several weeks. When I utilize them, I generally tell my patients that I want them to utilize them twice daily for about 2 to 3 weeks, and then I try to get them back into the office to evaluate their response. And if they're doing well at this point, then I do try to reduce to a less potent topical steroid to see how we can do it maintaining that benefit.
Well, you mentioned the use in a person with a discoid lesion. What about the person who has erythema with dermatomyositis on the face? Do you use steroids in that circumstance?
I do use topical steroids in patients with erythema from dermatomyositis. Dermatomyositis, I will say, just in general, is harder to treat than lupus is. But yes, I will, and on occasion, I will try a potent or ultra-potent topical steroid for a very limited time if a patient has intense facial pruritus and erythema to see if it helps. I can't say I am always successful with this trial, but I find that a few weeks is not a duration of time significant to cause significant atrophy, and patients appreciate a trial of a stronger agent. So I'll try it with dermatomyositis as well.
When might you use intralesional steroids?
Intralesional steroids can be really helpful, and I use them also mostly in discoid lupus patients. For those that have limited extent of disease in terms of body surface area, I will use intralesional steroids if they have failed to respond to an ultrapotent topical steroid after a few weeks.
What strength do you start with?
I used intralesional triamcin alone, 5 milligrams per ml for facial discoid lupus. And on the scalp, I'll sometimes just use 10 milligrams per ml. And I'll bring the patient back about a month later to assess their response and repeat in the same lesion, maybe another one or two times before giving up on this modality.
Do you ever use calcineurin inhibitors?
Occasionally I use the calcineurin inhibitors. Studies indicate that they're certainly safe to use in both of these diseases, so I don't worry about risk of worsening disease with calcineurin inhibitors. I find that they're slower to work than our topical steroids and that they aren't quite as efficacious, but certainly they have the benefit of not contributing to atrophy or telangiectasia over the long term. So for a patient who is going to need or desire a long-term topical agent, these are a nice choice to have.
Do you find any value in the use of retinoids, either with or without steroids?
Retinoids I don't tend to use topically very much for dermatomyositis or for cutaneous lupus. There have been a couple of reports of topical retinoids, tazarotene and tretinoin, being used in discoid lupus, perhaps with the idea being that they may reduce hyperkeratosis as well as have some anti-inflammatory effectiveness that then may have aided the use of topical steroids. But generally, I don't use them very much. I don't find them to be very helpful and not well tolerated by many patients.
Okay. We, of course, have to discuss antimalarials in both of these conditions. And you've already mentioned, and it's been my experience as well, that dermatomyositis is much harder to treat than lupus. But it's also been written with antimalarials that the side effect profile is worse in dermatomyositis and lupus. Do you find this to be true?
So dermatomyositis, yes, harder to treat. I still utilize antimalarials in both diseases as my first line systemic agent. And in dermatomyositis, there have been reports of a much greater likelihood of cutaneous adverse reactions to hydroxychloroquine than are seen in the lupus patients. In fact, in one center, a report that they published demonstrated that up to a third of the patients that they treated with dermatomyositis experienced cutaneous adverse reactions. When experts who treat lots of dermatomyositis get together and talk about this, it is a subject of great debate. And it seems that from center to center, experiences really vary, with some experts finding that they almost never see these reactions and others seeing it frequently. So the etiology, perhaps, of this remains a little bit elusive. I think what's important is to be aware that it's a possibility. And so if I'm treating a patient with dermatomyositis with antimalarials and they call and say, my skin rash is really worsening, I'm not automatically going to assume that it's their dermatomyositis that's worsening, and I'm going to bring them into the office and look at them to see whether it might be a drug eruption instead. Most often, the drug eruptions that have been reported in dermatomyositis receiving antimalarials are morbilliform drug eruptions, although there have been cases of more severe life-threatening cutaneous reactions.
Is it the same for hydroxychloroquine as it is for chloroquine?
So I don't know much data in terms of chloroquine inducing adverse cutaneous skin reactions in the dermatomyositis patients. In the U.S., I think most of us use more hydroxychloroquine than chloroquine as first line. There have been reports of patients having been switched to chloroquine and doing well, but I believe there have also been reports of them having rashes with that drug too. So it's not an absolute contraindication to trying the other, but you certainly want to do it cautiously.
Okay. Let's talk about the use of systemic steroids. Obviously, we don't want to use them, but at times we have to use them. What's your take on this?
So I do try to avoid systemic corticosteroids whenever possible, but there are times when they can be really beneficial. The main thing that's great about systemic corticosteroids is that they work quickly. So many of our therapies, systemic therapies in cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis have a very slow onset of action. And patients don't want to be told that they're going to have to wait 2 to 3 months for their antimalarials to kick in or other immunomodulating agents to begin to work. And if they have severe widespread disease, they may need that benefit that systemic corticosteroids can provide as a bridge until the other safer long-term immunomodulating agent can become effective.
So if you have a person with short-term systemic steroids, are you going to take precautions against bone loss with alendronate, or are you just going to tell them to take some vitamin D and calcium if it's just a few weeks? What's your approach in terms of protecting the side effects?
So I always recommend, because I'm planning on probably having these patients on maybe 6 to 8 weeks of corticosteroid therapy. So yes, I do certainly tell all of them about calcium and vitamin D supplementation. I warn them about adverse effects on the GI tract, may often put them on something like a ranitidine or an agent to protect the stomach. In terms of the bones, in a patient who I'm anticipating maybe 6 to 8 weeks of therapy, unless they have major risk factors for osteoporosis or underlying osteoporosis, in which case I'd probably work in conjunction with their rheumatologist or endocrinologist, I don't always utilize a bisphosphonate for a 6 to 8 week course. But if it's going to be longer than that, then I'm going to start having the bisphosphonate conversation with them as well.
Okay. When would you consider the use of other immunosuppressive agents such as azathioprine or mycophenolate mofetil?
I start thinking about using other immune-suppressing agents in any patient who has failed to respond adequately to combination antimalarial therapy. But of course, I'm very careful to give the combination antimalarial therapy adequate time to work. It really pays to give at least 2 to 3 months of the combination therapy a chance before deciding that it hasn't been efficacious. At this point, then, I go on to thinking about those types of drugs.
Have you had good success?
I have had successes, for sure. The problem is we don't have great evidence-based medicine to guide the choice of which agent to use next. And so deciding what drug to use is based largely on factors that include the efficacy based on anecdotal studies and small series, but also patient compliance, adverse effects, and comorbidities. So yes, I've had successes, but it's hard to say that I have a specific algorithm for which drug to use first after failure of the antimalarials.
Do you use methotrexate?
I do. I use methotrexate. I use it more often in cutaneous lupus than I do in dermatomyositis. And the reason for that is that methotrexate rarely can be associated with pulmonary fibrosis, and patients with dermatomyositis are at increased risk of interstitial lung disease. So I'm a little more cautious in using it in dermatomyositis. That's not to say I don't, but it's maybe not the first immune-suppressing drug I think of in dermatomyositis. In lupus, however, of all of the immunosuppressing agents out there, there's probably more evidence demonstrating methotrexate's utility than other agents.
When is IVIG recommended?
So IVIG is a drug that doesn't have a lot of great evidence to support its use for purely cutaneous manifestations of either dermatomyositis or lupus. Certainly there are studies looking at its usefulness in terms of the myositis component of dermatomyositis, where it can be helpful, or in systemic manifestations of systemic lupus erythematosus, and that's the reason that we think about it. It has the added benefit of not being an immune-suppressing drug for a patient where that's a concern. The downsides of IVIG, however, are its tremendous cost. It also is a drug that can induce anaphylaxis, particularly in patients that are IgA deficient, so that's sometimes a consideration. It has procoagulant properties, and patients with lupus in particular may be hypercoagulable for other reasons. Patients with malignancy-associated dermatomyositis may be hypercoagulable, so that has to be considered as well. And most of the limited series and looking at IVIG for skin manifestations of these diseases seem to show very quick relapses of disease as soon as IVIG therapy is discontinued. So we don't really know what the stopping point is of this very costly therapy. So I use it as a very late line agent is the bottom line.
A new drug was in the news because of the fact that it was the first drug approved for lupus in eons, and that's belimumab. Please tell us about that.
So belimumab, yes, it's exciting to have a new drug for systemic lupus. Unfortunately, what I'll say about belimumab is that in the trials that led to its approval, the skin was not exactly a primary outcome measure. And while the patients in the studies, they all had systemic lupus, and the studies reported an overall benefit in skin symptoms, they didn't really break down or critically analyze what type of skin manifestations were improving. So we don't have data to say exactly how belimumab might affect discoid lupus lesions or subacute cutaneous lupus lesions specifically. It's really a drug that has been utilized as an adjunct to other agents in the treatment of systemic lupus erythematosus, meaning it's added usually to other immune-suppressing agents to maintain controlled or milder systemic lupus erythematosus. It's not indicated for organ-threatening systemic lupus. But we don't know yet exactly where or if it's going to have a role in the treatment of the cutaneous manifestations of the disease.
So the jury's still out and we'll just
exactly.
Have to wait and see. We mentioned before cytokines such as tumor necrosis factor playing a role in lupus. Is there any value in the TNF inhibitors in the disease?
So there are a few studies in lupus and in dermatomyositis, in which patients have been treated with these various TNF inhibitors with good responses. However, I think most dermatologists are aware of the induction of ANAs, autoantibodies, and drug-induced lupus from the TNF inhibitors as well. And at this point, I really think that because we know that TNF inhibitors contribute to a pro-inflammatory milieu in the skin similar to that seen in the lesions of lupus and dermatomyositis. And because we know that some patients really do develop a drug-induced lupus from these, I think they really should be used with extreme caution. I don't think they can be recommended at this time for the treatment of either lupus or dermatomyositis.
In terms of the biologic agents, let's say you have a person with psoriasis who has a family history of lupus and you decide to check an ANA and it's a low titer positive. Would you be afraid to administer the TNF inhibitors to that patient?
I don't believe that I would consider it an absolute contraindication to doing so. I would certainly be very cautious, and this would be a patient who I would have a long and frank discussion about this risk and about potential symptoms of a drug-induced lupus type of syndrome. If it was the best choice for managing their psoriasis, however, I wouldn't say no to it, but I would do it carefully.
Okay. Are there new therapies on the horizon that we're going to be hearing about?
I hope so. Okay. I think the answer is yes. There are a number of studies actually currently recruiting, looking at things ranging from actually UVA1 therapy in lupus.
Courageous.
To various, yes, I'm not doing that one, but it's listed on clinicaltrials.gov, which I think is a great website for people to go to look for what may be recruiting in your area when you have a patient that might benefit from a study. UVA1 phototherapy to new sunscreen agents to more molecularly directed therapies, Janus kinase inhibitors and anti-inflammatory drugs like phosphodiesterase inhibitors, drugs similar to apremilast, are being evaluated for cutaneous lupus. So I think we're going to see new drugs on the horizon. It's really a challenge because cutaneous lupus is relatively uncommon, and it's hard to get great numbers of patients in big studies. So I don't know that we'll see any big breakthrough FDA approvals like we did with belimumab, but I'm hoping we'll have some more options in the near future.
So what therapeutic gems would you like to leave our listeners with?
I guess a few points. One of them is that all of us are, as I mentioned earlier, we all know an awful lot about photoprotection. And I really think that this is an aspect of the care of our patients with cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis that we can play a role in at each and every visit. And that patients, just like our skin cancer patients, tend to forget about a little bit or maybe underestimate. So I think that that's somewhere we all have a role and a responsibility in caring for these patients. Another important thing for us to be aware of is that both diseases actually can sometimes be triggered by medications. And we need to be really careful to look at medication lists when we're managing these patients or diagnosing them to see if they may be on a drug that's reported to cause or trigger or worsen these dermatoses. We sometimes prescribe some photosensitizing drugs ourselves, and we need to be mindful of that. So thinking about medications. And I guess finally, the impact that these two diseases have on quality of life really just can't be underestimated. We've learned a lot by looking at quality of life studies, I think, in psoriasis and atopic dermatitis, and now we're starting to do that with lupus and dermatomyositis and finding that the patients who have even skin-limited manifestations of these diseases have quality of life akin to patients with chronic diseases like coronary artery disease. And while they may be less common conditions that affect fewer patients, these patients are certainly worthy of quality research to address their disease because they are just devastating.
Well, Jenny, this was magnificent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
The cutaneous lesions in both dermatomyositis and cutaneous lupus are often photosensitive. To reduce the associated erythema, these patients benefit from photoprotection with sun avoidance and routine sunscreen use. Physicians should advise their patients to use a high SPF sunscreen that is both broad-spectrum and water-resistant. Additionally, some patients may benefit from UV filters for their vehicles, particularly those who spend significant time driving. For patients practicing strict sun avoidance, vitamin D supplementation is recommended. Topical and intralesional steroids can be an effective treatment for discoid lupus. Despite the risks of atrophy, the benefit of high-potency topical steroids to reduce scarring is often warranted in these patients. Calcineurin inhibitors can also be helpful in both cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis with the benefit of fewer side effects than topical steroids. Unfortunately, calcineurin inhibitors take longer than steroids to achieve maximum therapeutic benefit. When patients have more severe disease that is not amenable to topical therapy, antimalarial medications such as hydroxychloroquine are often a first-line systemic medication for lupus and dermatomyositis. In addition, some patients may benefit from the addition of quinacrine. While this medication is effective, it can be difficult to obtain because it is not commercially available and must be obtained through a compounding pharmacy. Systemic steroids can be beneficial for some patients. They have the advantage of working more rapidly compared to other systemic medications that may take months to take effect. When systemic steroids are utilized, it is important to counsel patients in the associated risks, including HPA axis suppression, osteoporosis, gastritis, hyperglycemia, weight gain, and cataract formation. Patients should be counseled and prophylactically treated with calcium and vitamin D. Osteoporosis prophylaxis should be considered in high-risk patients and those who receive steroids for extended periods of time. Other immunosuppressants are often utilized in those who have a contraindication to steroid use or do not respond to first-line antimalarial therapies. Unfortunately, great evidence-based algorithms for these options do not exist. IVIG can be beneficial for lupus and dermatomyositis. However, evidence is lacking for cutaneous manifestations. The medication's high cost, risk of anaphylaxis in IgA-deficient patients, and risk for thromboembolism must be considered prior to use. TNF inhibitors have been studied for both lupus and dermatomyositis. However, given the risk of drug-induced lupus, these options are often avoided or used with extreme caution.